First, UK news with our regular UK correspondent Ian Dunt from politics.co.uk. And one of Ian's skills, as we all know, is marriage guidance counselling. Ian, I believe you've been a bit busy with Boris.
Yeah, he's having a bit of a difficult time in his personal life, so he's now got a divorce. It looks like he's been chucked. There are rumours, pretty strong rumours, that he's been sort of cavorting with this 30-year-old Tory sort of official, really, sort of a blonde woman who's now been dragged through the tabloids in the way that you would expect. I mean, the stuff that's said about her is, you know, overly ambitious and prizing her way into power in a way that, of course, would never be said about a man. So she's having a very, very difficult time indeed, and as is Boris Johnson. But he has been trying consistently to just try and pivot away from that issue.
But hasn't the Johnson marriage failed before?
Several times.
Yeah.
He's not very good at... look at it this way. His entire strategy for Brexit was literally, I want my cake and eat it. And I think probably that has quite a lot of explanatory power when it comes to his romantic entanglements as well.
Well, talking about eating cake or quite a few other dishes, I understood that Boris took his mistress to a Valentine's Day lunch at Rule's Restaurant in Covent Garden. That's very charming.
yeah, it is. It is. It's quite daring. I mean, you never really know. You know, there was obviously an awful lot of forgiveness in his home life previously, and that is not the case now. I'm never too sure, really, about how much of an impact this has on anyone politically anymore. It certainly used to in the 80s and the 90s. That this was quite a big deal. We had a time, John Major, a politician in the early 90s, the Prime Minister, who did a speech called Back to Basics, where he talked about traditional family values and, you know, the smack of the, you know, the wickets when people play cricket on the village green. And as soon as he did that, it opened up a justification to peer into the lives of every MP and go, well, are they standing up for these good, wholesome family values? And very many of them most demonstrably were not. Things have changed quite a bit since then. When David Cameron became Tory leader, there are a lot of stories about him doing cocaine in his youth. And he managed to survive them quite easily with this sort of like, oh, you know, youthful indiscretions, guys, blah, blah. And because that went so well for him, it sort of rejigged some of the moral frameworks of how British politics operate. And there's no less interest in their lives, especially when things like this happen. But there is much less judgment. And actually, divorces and cheating and even sort of drugs and things like that don't tend to have the same impact that they used to back in the day.
Well, as long as you don't inhale. And of course, Trump has changed the terms of reference colossally, hasn't he?
Yes. I mean, that is a standard below which you would not necessarily want to go. So hopefully there is still a basis that if you say that you sexually assault women, that would be considered an obstacle to a political career in a way that it clearly is not in the United States right now. And you're right that is, you know, fundamentally rejigged things. But it seems positive, broadly positive, that there's less judgment. You know, Boris Johnson has almost no redeeming qualities, certainly not in politics. He is a very, very bleak figure to have in a prominent position. He has no ideas of his own. All he's really interested in is his own advancement. One of his flaws, however, is not really his personal life, which should be of very little people's interest and doesn't really seem to be of that many people's interest either, apart from the tabloids.
He has a very close, warm and loving relationship with the Prime Minister, though, doesn't he?
Not so much anymore. She is now currently embroiled. I mean, she's having a really hard time out there, although I suppose I have said that to you pretty much every sort of 2 weeks that I've been here. There was a meeting last night of the European Research Group, which is a group of backbench Tory MPs who do not understand anything about Europe and certainly don't do any research and aren't even really a group because they're just a WhatsApp group. So I don't know if that really formally classes you as an organisation. There was 30 of them in the room, not including Boris this time, but he usually is around that circle, openly plotting how they were going to get rid of the Prime Minister. I know this stuff seems laughably sweet and polite compared to the rather more cutthroat way that you guys get rid of your Prime Ministers, but it nevertheless sort of suggested that there'd been a qualitative change in the manner in which it was discussed. In that meeting yesterday, usually these guys, these guys that clearly wanted to topple her, would go in with a lot of, oh, look, it's a real disaster. I'm very sad to say it, but I've been forced to come to the conclusion that we need to. None of that yesterday. Yesterday, it was just like, how do we get rid of her? How do we adopt this strategy that we can do it? And they said all of that while knowing that number 10's spies were in the room. They could see them there and they said it anyway. So you get this impression that for a few of them, for the real hard Brexit diehards, maybe about now to take their final shot at her.
Who writes his material? Who would he come up with a phrase like suicide vest?
Yeah, so this is, I mean, this is what he said about her negotiating strategy, specifically over Ireland. I mean, Britain's basically signed up to say, we will make sure there's no border in Ireland. The only way you can do that is by coming into regulatory alignment with the EU, and the Brexiters won't accept that. Now, he calls that, I think he described it as a suicide vest, and he's handed the detonator to Brussels. And of course, there's quite a lot of outrage when that comes out. I mean, it's extremely evocative, is not even really the word for how aggressive that metaphor is. Some people suggest that this is the strategy of another of your countrymen, Linton Crosby, who has a strategy called the dead cat.
When anyone mentions the name of Linton Crosby, I stand in the studio as a sign of respect.
Yeah, look, he has. At one time, he was considered this sort of electoral deity in British politics. That has fallen quite a bit. I mean, he sort of helped out a bit in Theresa May's campaign, which went very, very badly. So his star has fallen somewhat. But nevertheless, there's a strategy called dead cat, which is basically when you're in trouble for one thing over here, you launch a completely unrelated thing by making some very colourful comments on something else over here. It distracts everybody and you get away from your original problem. And the suggestion is that to get away from his marital issues, he then goes to the Daily Mail, writes this piece, says suicide vest, and knows that the debate goes elsewhere, something which hasn't worked, if indeed that was the strategy. I think also the danger with seeing things, once we learn about these kind of PR strategies in politics, is we assume they're happening everywhere. And it isn't always the case that these things go in that way. And I'm not entirely convinced that Boris Johnson would be happier talking about that than he would be about his marriage.
It seems only yesterday I was gazing in wonderment and a considerable feeling of approval at the celebration of the National Health Service in the opening ceremonies of the London Olympics. Mm. Now it seems that the National Health Service is pretty much demolished. There's a discussion of a sell-off and news of major, major, major staff shortages.
Yeah, the staff shortages situation is quite severe, actually. It's for nurses and doctors. And this is one of those areas that Brexit threatens to make much, much worse. 95% of European nurses working in the NHS say that they are thinking about leaving. And even if you were to say, well, we're going to keep everyone and keep on bringing people over, there is a problem with the mutual recognition of qualifications between the UK and the EU. 10% of doctors in this country are relying on European qualifications. If there's no deal on those qualifications, and if there's no deal in Brexit, everything is in that deal. So if there's no deal on one thing, there's no deal on anything. Those doctors would have to go too. There is then the problem with Britain's aging population. And again, this plays into immigration. You know, the way a human life operates is you take more money from the state at the beginning in education and in healthcare, and you take more money from the state at the end of your life in pensions and in healthcare. And in the middle, you pay in. Britain has an aging population. It simply has too many old people requiring social care, requiring pensions, requiring healthcare, and not enough young people. The solution to that problem is either people have more children, which is frankly quite a hard thing to enforce at a government level, or you bring in immigrants. Of course, Britain has now decided that immigration is some kind of danger to its sort of constituency for reasons that it cannot quite articulate. So all of these problems, combined with austerity, combined with a lack of productivity in the British economy, are putting massive strain on the NHS. We're not at the point of sell-off yet, and mostly because it is almost an item of national religion. It's probably the one thing that unites almost any part of the political spectrum. It's quite rare that you speak to someone who's so right-wing they would suggest privatising the NHS. It's an almost unheard-of opinion. So governments are very, very wary of going near it. But nevertheless, the strain is very, very severe, and it is set to get worse, especially if Brexit goes as badly as we expect.
Talking of drugs, medical drugs, I'd like to raise the issue of Novichok, because I understand the CCTV of the Russian spies was very revealing.
Yeah, well, we've now seen the images of these two guys. who came over. They seem to have stayed for 2 or 3 days, one day in London, then down to Salisbury to do the attack, and then obviously getting back to Russia as quickly as they can. It's revealing that the British authorities have even released that footage. And it's all part of what is, in reality, at this point, a PR battle. Because, of course, there is no suggestion whatsoever these guys are ever going to be deported from Russia to face charges in the UK. That's basically unthinkable. Today, Vladimir Putin came out, said that they're private citizens, denies that they're Russian spies in any way, and says that they need to go talk to, you know, to the TV cameras, which one presumes is part and parcel of a carefully orchestrated scheme in order to present it in this manner. They've been released. Again, no one is expecting them to come back here. So this, just like the diplomatic expulsions that you saw from several allies of the UK, is really a PR battle rather than a criminal battle at this stage.
Before I let you go, Ian, an update on the issue of anti-Semitism and the Labour Party.
Continues to be unspeakably dreadful, really. I mean, just almost daily sense of astonishment that it could get so bad. The latest story, I mean, there's new ones breaking all the time, but the latest story is basically about a piece of graffiti in the Warsaw ghetto. And it's about, it says, "Free Gaza." The content of the graffiti is obviously not problematic. The fact that it was put up in the Warsaw ghetto, as if the sort of Jews as a race are responsible for the actions of the Israeli government and the manner in which they conduct those actions, is, of course, I mean, quite bleak stuff. Now, the person who spray painted that has been invited to Momentum's conference, which takes place in parallel to the Labour conference. Momentum is a sort of radical left group which exists inside of the Labour Party and wields tremendous power inside of the Labour Party, having MPs being deselected, trying to bring their own people up to sort of take on the mechanisms, the sort of core structures of the party, something they've been tremendously efficient at. And they are still planning on having this person there. What's amazing as this thing rumbles on, I mean, we've just had Jewish New Year, you talk to an awful lot of Jewish people now, and Jewish Labour supporters, and not people who are tremendously sort of overexcitable, but you will hear over and over conversations taking place around the dinner table saying, if Jeremy Corbyn becomes Prime Minister, we are thinking about leaving this country, which is the kind of thing that when you hear it said, the pure sense of horror at the point that we have reached is extraordinary. And yet, we hear almost nothing from Jeremy Corbyn whatsoever. Not only that, we don't even really hear anything from his front bench, who seem embarrassed. I mean, even the quite left-wing ones who support his programme, they're acting like they didn't go into politics in order to justify acts of anti-Semitism, which is something you can hardly, you know, think badly of them for. So instead, they are replaced by really online journalists who are there, sort of Corbynista journalists, who are more and more and more provocative and thereby pushing the party into an even more sort of indefensible position. It's pretty bleak stuff.
Ian, thanks for that. Ian Dunt, who of course is editor of politics.co.uk, and who is our regular voice of the UK on the Little Wireless programme.